From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Suzanne Paola Antoinetta is my guest. She's the author of The Terrible Unlikelihood of Our Being Here and other works of nonfiction, fiction, and poetry. Her latest book is The Devil's Castle, Nazi Eugenics, Euthanasia, and How Psychiatry's Troubled History Reverberates Today. Suzanne Paola Antoinetta, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary. Thanks for having me.
I know you've published a lot of books, including a New York Times notable book, an American Book Award, a Library Journal Best Science book. But this book seems like it's very personal and that you've been working on it for a long time. Did you feel compelled to tell these stories?
I very much did feel compelled to tell these stories. I felt as if the story that I cover in there, which is what happened in Germany during World War II to their psychiatric population, which was killed in gas chambers before the Holocaust, it just felt to me like a story that's not over. We're not just still doing psychiatry following a lot of the lead of Germany, quite literally, but we still are making so many value judgments about who is worthwhile and who can be helped. And, you know, I'm in that population. I was diagnosed first as schizophrenic and then as bipolar when I was very, very young. So, yes, I feel very connected to this story of psychiatry, kind of how we got where we're at today, which I think is in a place that many people are unhappy, and I don't think our methods are working terribly well for most of them.
Well, if you don't mind, I want to know more about your own, I don't know, do you say mental health, or what do you call it?
Well, I think that it's important to go into this conversation about using the terms health and illness, understanding that those are metaphorical terms. There isn't anything that happens in the brain that's comparable to, like, the body needing insulin in diabetes or something like that. And I think for some people, it's a really helpful metaphor to think of brain illness and brain health. It became for me a negative metaphor and one that I've discarded. I'm just, I think, put together very differently mentally than most people are. But I think that's a source of strength and something that I work with and not against in my own life.
So what, instead of the words mental health, what should we say? Mental state of being, or?
Well, yeah, we have mental states and traits, right? Some of us are more anxious than others. Some of us are shyer than others. Those are traits. We all get, you know, depression happens. It's terrible, and that's a mental state. And I think some people are, you know, neurodivergent or neuroatypical compared to the norm. So I think those can be useful terms. I think, honestly, sometimes if you live with, you know, in a state of being different neurologically, being a different neurotype, if you want to put it that way, you kind of have to come up with a language that works for you. And as I said, you know, if the metaphor of I'm ill works for you, if it helps you get to a better place, then that's fine. It's just important to understand that it's not literally true. There's never been anything that people have found in the brain that qualifies as illness in the way that, you know, COVID does, right. Which is on my mind, Gary, because as I shared with you earlier, I'm just coming out of a Christmas case of COVID.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm glad you're feeling better. So when you were, you said you, when you were young, well, how old were you when you discovered that you were neurally divergent?
Well, I kept diaries starting around the age of 10, and I still have my old diaries, so I'm aware of the fact that I always knew I was mentally divergent. It's something I wrote about frequently. Mm. I didn't get into the system till I was about 14, and that's when things took a turn in my life, because I had been able to kind of manage my own flights, or whatever you want to call them, pretty well. But once I got into the system and was getting medication and shock treatment thrown at me, then I actually became depressed in a, you know, more clinical way that wouldn't go away. So for me, that was always a turning point, but not a good one.
So you would say that psychiatric treatment was bad for you?
think at times it has been, yes. I think it's been a lifelong process, and I've had several really brilliant doctors who really helped me, so I wouldn't say it's been all bad. Two of the best people I've ever known were psychiatrists, and they were hugely helpful to me. One of them was also neurodivergent, and I think that made a really big difference in her care. So I'm not an anti-psychiatrist. I think it needs to exist, and I think it needs reforming right now. But it's been a mixed bag, but I think that the kind of medical philosophy my life overlaps with, which is that we're going to treat this as a biological brain disease, we're going to consider it a problem of neurotransmitters and things like that and give you medication, I think that has not worked well for me, but I don't think it's worked well for, so much of our population now is being medicated, and our population's level of unhappiness keeps going up and not down. So I think it's fair to say I don't think this has worked well for us as a population, I guess.
Well, Suzanne Paola Antonetta, if you had had the capacity at age 10 to read The Devil's Castle, and if that book had existed then, would it have helped you?
Yes, it would have helped me. And I can tell you very specifically what helped me. And that was coming across the German writer and activist and Nazi victim, Dorothea Buck, who was sterilized at 19 because it was 1936, and Hitler had decided to get schizophrenia out of the population. He believed it was genetic, and so many schizophrenics were put to death and many others were sterilized. I want to include here that the rate of schizophrenia in Germany never went down. Mm. So that genetic theory was pretty much blown out of the water in a terrible way. But Buck actually came up with her own methods for dealing with her own psychotic episodes, but the depression and psychoses of many other people. She called it trialogue. And it was very patient-centered, very much about learning your triggers, learning how to turn things around before things get bad. Our system is set up to deal with people in their worst cases, not to prevent those from happening. And so just applying Buck's thinking to my own life changed my care drastically, and including, I went down on medication significantly. So there are better ways to do things. And yes, if I'd read that at 14, it would have been hugely helpful. I could have saved myself a lot of time.
You wouldn't even have to have written it because it would have already been written. And then
there you go. That's very twisty. That's kind of Matrix. But okay, yes.
You've made a study about the rise of fascism in Germany. I mean, you talked about, I was thinking about this when there was the Nazis stripped German citizens of their rights so that they could then persecute them. And the Supreme Court of the United States is now considering stripping birthright citizenship. And we've heard a lot about the rise of fascism in the United States in the last 12 months. And so I wonder, do you see parallels between the rise of the Nazis and our current situation? And is that alarming?
It's extremely alarming, and certainly I do. I mean, one of the things that the current administration does and has done is just othering people. And the Nazis did an incredible amount of othering. And while they did strip rights from most Germans, you have to understand that they kind of compensated. If you were an Aryan German, you had additional rights under Hitler. You had like baby allowances and marriage allowances and lots of things like that. So they created a highly, two-tiered, hierarchical, better citizens and worse citizens system. And I really see that happening now. And I see so much eugenic thinking around. It kind of cracked me up, the whole Sydney Sweeney genes ad, Sydney Sweeney has good genes. It just shows you how eugenics is simmering below the surface all the time, because nobody stopped and thought, what do they mean by that? What's the pun? It was just kind of immediate. And, she's blonde and I gather blue-eyed. I think she's blue-eyed.
No one's looking at her eyes.
Maybe not, but I'm not that familiar with her, but I do know that she's very fair and very kind of Aryan looking. And, you know, so immediately the very valid question goes out, would we have done this ad with a different performer? So I think that I am seeing that, you know, that creation of hierarchies, that othering of so many people, and just this idea that, you know, that there are good genes and bad genes, which is just, I mean, it shows a terrible misunderstanding of genes themselves, which are proteins that can recode themselves and change themselves, and they don't have this fixed meaning that we think they do. So, well, yeah, I see many different ways in which I think we're kind of pointing that way.
Well, the subtitle of the Devil's Castle, Nazi Eugenics, Euthanasia, and How Psychiatry's Troubled History Reverberates Today, tells us that there are elements of Nazi philosophy that are still a part of modern American psychiatric treatment. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Well, you know, there have only been two times where psychiatry went to a very strongly biological disease model. And one was pre-war Germany and one was the United States, starting around 1980, when a group of doctors who modeled themselves on the German doctor Emil Kraepelin, they called themselves the Neo-Kraepelinians, revised RDSM, which is the document we use to diagnose people. It's absolutely the heart blood of our system. You can't get reimbursed from insurance if you don't have a DSM code. So they went back to Kraepelin, who claimed, you know, people don't have bad lives. They just have bad brains. And if their life is bad, their brain was bad first. And they basically said the same thing and, you know, almost wiped psychology out of the picture. So people, you know, women going to doctors with trauma from abusive relationships, you know, having survived assault, various things that, of course, are going to affect you. You know, the treatment just became drugs. And, you know, it's just, again, not an experiment that has worked out, I think, particularly well. And it is, I think, a shame that we won't go back to somebody like the German doctor Emil Kraepelin and say, we want to model ourselves on you, because he trained the Nazi doctors. He was not a good guy.
Well, I was fascinated reading about euthanasia in your book. In fact, just the word euthanasia, that's not a word the Germans used. It's an American word. Is that what you, is that right?
Yes, it's English, and it just means a beautiful, EU means good or beautiful, a good death. And of course, they weren't giving out a good death. They were giving out, you know, horrible deaths. But they used the term mercy death, and they even used that term in the camps. It was just whitewashing of language.
And there was a euthanasia movement before the Nazis in the United States? There was euthanasia?
Yes, there was a very strong euthanasia movement in the United States. The idea to use gas chambers to kill people with mental disorders came from the U.S. It came from the Carnegie Institute in 1918 on a list of sort of possible solutions. And unbelievably, even in 1942, when we were in the midst of the war, we knew about the German euthanasia program. We knew that they had killed all these innocent people simply for having a diagnosis. We were still debating it here. There's a famous 1942 debate between two doctors, a psychiatrist and a neurologist, publicly about whether children born with what they called defects should be put to death right away rather than allowed to live. So it was a, you know, an idea that was attractive to a lot of Americans for a very long time.
Well, in the book, someone says, and I can't remember everybody's name, but a German says, well, if people don't object to having family members euthanized, then why would they object to anyone else being euthanized?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That was a German historian named Goetz Ali. And what he said was he was convinced, and he's really, you know, spent his life studying these questions, that if there had been even limited protests in 1941 to the German euthanasia program, that would have slowed down drastically the Holocaust. Because they really did. And I mean, this comes up again in the book in several you know, historical documents. They did feel like if people are going to sit by and allow this to happen, they're not going to object when we go after these other populations that aren't even, you know, really German in the way they looked at it.
Do you feel there's an absence of protest today in the United States?
That's a wonderful question, Gary, and I'm not sure what the answer is. I think the protests have been very meaningful, and obviously they've bugged the administration. I think that we're all kind of trying to figure out what is the most productive thing to do. And I don't think anybody really knows. I think we're, you know, seeing a lot of the government dismantled and worrying about it, but it's almost like things are happening in a way that is much less easy to protest than, say, the Vietnam War was, which I was out protesting against when I was really young. It's not quite the same when there's a doge running around, you know, just knocking out the government. So I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I think we're all figuring it out, but I certainly think that there are lots of people standing up and calling out what's wrong.
Well, but you were just alluding to the 60s and the Vietnam War of 70s protests, and you were young. I don't see a lot of young people at protests. Everybody's my age.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Yeah, I suppose that we kind of have it in our, you know, in our blood almost, because we were doing it when we were really young. And, you know, when I was in college, we wanted our college to divest from South Africa. This was way back, you know, during the days of apartheid. So we occupied the president's office. I mean, it just, I think it just came naturally to my generation. I think this generation is, you know, they're struggling with a lot more than we did in other areas of life. So I don't know that I blame them. But yes, it might be that one of these days we need to bring back that.
Yeah.
That history.
So your book is called The Devil's Castle, Suzanne Paola Antonetta. And what is The Devil's Castle?
The Devil's Castle was the name given to Sonnenstein Asylum, which was one of the five asylums that had a gas chamber built into it before the war. And one of my subjects, along with Dorothea Buck, is a German judge named Paul Schreiber, who was hospitalized there and who litigated his own release. He served as his own attorney. And when he saw the place, he said, "This is the Devil's Castle. It reeks of corpses." And this was long before the war. It was long before the gas chamber was put in there. So one of the things I write about is how I think neurodiverse people often have kind of almost a different set of antenna. Like what other people feel is their psychosis or their crazy visions. They're seeing things that are very real. He knew, he kind of saw that coming, and Dorothea Buck did as well. She saw the war in exactly the form it was going to take on in 1936, and her, you know, her family dragged her to a doctor because they thought she was crazy. But she was right. She had really seen how evil World War II was going to be. And I like to say I wish other Germans had had her symptom.
Right.
Because she was really determined that they needed to stop Hitler before he could start a war.
And she survived the war. She lived to be in her 70s, is that right? Or older?
She lived to be 102.
Oh, uh-huh. Wow.
And she was out protesting into her 90s. She was just an amazing, ferocious woman. And yeah, she became an activist for better psychiatry and against biological psychiatry, because that was kind of starting in her day. And she also became an activist demanding the government recognize the crimes against people with psychiatric diagnoses, because they haven't really.
And she was an artist.
And she was an artist, yeah. She was a sculptor. She did beautiful kind of German expressionist sculpting. In the 60s, when she learned about the euthanasia program, she actually dropped her art very consciously and said, you know, there's nobody to remember these people, and I can't do art anymore. This is what I'm going to dedicate the rest of my life to. And she did.
She never returned to art?
She did not return to art, no. I have one of her pieces. I mean, there's not much of it left. She lived in Hamburg, which was firebombed, and So there's not a lot of buck work left, but I found a foundry that had a mold, and I had them cast this beautiful mother and child bronze for me.
So the Holocaust is really born in this treatment of neurodiversity. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. And when they started the euthanasia program, they would do these very minimal 1 to 2 minute screenings of people who were put up for what they called selection. And in that case, the doctor was just looking mostly to see if they could work. Could this person be part of the war effort? No, they're probably going to be eliminated. But Jews were automatically eliminated. They weren't examined. And as the program went on, and I think this has happened in American psychiatry, but in a very different way, things like being what they called antisocial, alien to the community was a German term. All these things came to be considered mental illnesses. Basically, I don't like you became a diagnosis. And throughout the whole thing, and they, you know, when they started killing people at the camps, they did it by putting them under the umbrella of the euthanasia program. And in that case, they really were going after Jews. And you can read, I mean, we still have diaries of doctors who did this. And they would record, well, 50 of them were Jews, so we didn't even look at them. One historian I quote in there said Himmler just kind of outsourced the Holocaust to the euthanasia program till he was ready to really gear it up.
So of those people who decided on the final solution and the meeting that's been written about.
The Wannsee Conference, yeah.
How many of those were doctors, and how did doctors contribute to that final solution?
Well, Karl Brandt was a big part of creating the Holocaust. So there were doctors involved, and there were also, you know, just the bureaucrats like Adolf Eichmann. But I think what was important when the Wannsee Conference happened and when they were discussing setting up the death camps was that they had had the personnel, they had developed and tested gas chambers. Everything was ready because of the euthanasia program, and they were using it pretty deliberately as a way to acclimate these doctors and nurses, create the logistics, create the personnel, because they shut down that program and moved them east and then began the Holocaust. So it was a kind of a seamless thing. And it's heartbreaking. And seeing the recurrences of anti-Semitism now is really heartbreaking.
Yeah, it hasn't gone away.
No, it hasn't gone away.
And there's also a thing that happens. The Germans were kind of the first, maybe not the first, but they're the most prominent example of not using a euphemism for anti-Semitism. Just go ahead and say, we hate Jews. Whereas here, right. We have all these different ways of talking about Jews. I mean, the blacklist is a perfect example in which, you know, I can't think of any blacklisted actors, directors, writers in the Hollywood blacklist who were not Jewish.
That's correct, yes. Well, there was that, another, you know, ongoing thing is the Jewish communist connection, which there wasn't, of course, in reality. But Jews during the McCarthy period were closely tied with communist ideologies. And so it just feels like, it's just you create these connections between people and you dehumanize them. And that's the German playbook, but we're still using that playbook.
When President Trump uses anti-Semitism as a reason for... or doing certain things, cutting off funding to schools or whatever. I always find that, this kind of twisting what anti-Semitism is today, very strange.
Yes, it's really strange. And of course, you know, it's just so odd too, coming from somebody who continually praises the genes of Northern Europeans. So I think there's both discourses going on out of this administration.
And that's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah. I don't know if I meant it to be nice, but I think you understand what I mean. Yeah.
So how have people responded to your book? You've been on a book tour. You've met a lot of your readers or potential readers. What's happening? How's that going?
It's been going really well. And, you know, I understand it is, you know, at times it's a dark read. But I think the book also just has a lot of optimism about the fact that we have much better ways of doing things. We have much better ways of approaching mind care. And I hope I'm pretty specific in there about some of the things that have worked. So, yeah, I think a lot of people are just finding it on their own, and that's been really gratifying. I think a lot of people just want to understand why we have a population that feels so bad so much of the time when there's so much, you know, so many people on medication and diagnosed and, you know, presumably being taken care of, it's not really working. So that's kind of what I hear a lot of from people that I talk to. Why isn't this working? This makes a little more sense to me now.
Well, I don't know how to ask this. What would you say to parents, say, of a 11-year-old who's suddenly been diagnosed? You know, how should they approach dealing with a neurodivergent child?
Well, I think, first of all, it's really important, and I think this is something that you can get straight from my book, because I do go into neuroscience a lot, and the fact that all the research we do on perception and on consciousness shows that our minds are incredibly different, right? It's not like, you know, it's not like our 99% of shared genes gives us some kind of inner, you know, we don't all have the same inner playbook. People think drastically differently. Some people think in images. Some people have like inner personalities that come out and think for them. It's really fascinating that one of the neuroscientists I interviewed, Anil Seth, said that if we really understood neurodiversity, it would be as transformative and important as our understanding of our other diversities. And so I think one of the first things to say is, you know what, the mind is incredibly different. Like 17 to 20% of the population hear voices. If they get to a doctor, sometimes it's the worst thing that could happen to them, because they're going to get slammed with medication they probably don't need. So I think the first thing is to understand that we are all mentally really, really different, because we're all trained to have this kind of fear of our minds. And I think the second thing is to talk about what, you know, a blessing it is, and how many truly gifted people have been very neurodiverse and how much they've contributed. And we're all still around, you know, for a reason.
The Devil's Castle, Nazi eugenics, euthanasia, and how psychiatry's troubled history reverberates today. And the author, my guest, Suzanne Paola Antonetta. Thank you for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Gary. I really enjoyed it.
I'm happy to welcome Julie Farnham back to the show this week. She is the author of a fabulous book. It is called Domestic Darkness, An Insider's Account of the January 6th Insurrection and the Future of Right-Wing Extremism. And it's a fabulous book, and she knows what she's talking about, because she was the assistant director of intelligence, I think I'm getting this right, of the D.C. Police Department on the day of the January 6th insurrection. And she's also a brilliant writer and expert on lots of things, and so I asked her to come by and chat with us. And Julie, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. And just one correction, I was the assistant director of intelligence for the Capitol Police.
The Capitol Police. Okay, good. Sorry.
Yes.
Yes. And before that, you worked in Homeland Security for a dozen years or so.
Yes, for about 15 years, a little over 15 years.
All right. So Julie Farnham, she's not able to hold on to a job. So that's the problem. The White House has posted on their website, whitehouse.gov, a description of all the things that happened on January 6th, 2021. And they say, for instance, that President Trump, I'll just quote a little bit of it, President Trump took decisive action to pardon January 6th defendants who were unfairly targeted, overcharged. I don't know what they were overcharged for. you should ask for a refund, overcharged and used as political examples. They were not protected by the leaders who failed them. They were punished to cover incompetence. On his first day back in office, January 20th, 2025, President Trump issued sweeping blanket pardons and commutations for nearly 1,600 patriotic Americans prosecuted for their presence at the Capitol. Many mere trespassers or peaceful protesters treated as insurrectionists by a weaponized Biden DOJ. He fully pardoned most commuted sentences and ordered immediately release of all those imprisoned, ending years of harsh solitary confinement, denied due process, and family separation for exercising their First Amendment rights. Thousands of Americans paid the price for political failures they did not create. Since January 6, 2021, Nancy Pelosi spent over 3 years and nearly $20 million in taxpayer funds on her partisan select committee, producing a scripted TV spectacle to fabricate an insurrection narrative and pin all the blame on President Trump. Video and audio recordings, including unaired HBO footage from her own daughter, show Nancy Pelosi repeatedly acknowledging responsibility for the catastrophic security failures, admitting, "We have totally failed. I take full responsibility." And so I find this interesting that they are blaming Democrats and Nancy Pelosi when really we know that you are to blame for the insurrection on January 6th. Isn't that correct?
Exactly. My name is frequently mentioned when it comes to January 6th and who caused it. Yes.
Did you see this, and what were your feelings about this on January 6th this year?
I did see it, and I have a lot of thoughts about it. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, I think one of the things that stands out to me is, you know, their lack of due process. Like, all those people went to court. A lot of them pled guilty, or they were convicted. Most of the people who were tried were convicted. There are a couple acquittals, but most were convicted. So they had their due process. They had their day in court. And I think it's interesting coming from the president when we've seen a pretty steady erosion of due process rights in this country. We see that with immigrants. We see it with others. We see it with a lot of the executive orders that are stripping people's rights away. And so due process, whether you agree with a person or, you know, even the protesters, I believe that they have due process rights and they should have their day in court and they should have the opportunity to, you know, explain themselves or present evidence that they weren't guilty. You know, that's really important. That's one of the fundamentals of this country, is that we do have due process rights and that we do have a court system and a justice system to give people the opportunity to find justice and get justice. And so to say that they didn't have due process, I just don't see that. Go ahead.
No, you continue, please.
And then I was going to say about Nancy Pelosi. She's, you know, I think she's a very smart woman. I've briefed her before. I think she bears the brunt of a lot of the politics around January 6th and some of the other things pertaining to the current president. Some, you know, some of it is because of what her position was as Speaker of the House, and every Speaker of the House is always going to be a lightning rod for political division and politics in general. That goes with the territory. But I do think she's been unfairly treated when it comes to January 6th. And that topic, I don't think she was fully briefed on what was going to happen or what we thought was going to happen. And I say that because, and I mentioned this in the book as well, you know, I briefed her a few months after January 6th about something else that was going on in the Capitol. And I said, you know, these are the possible scenarios. This is the one that we think is most likely. And at the end of it, she was like, why didn't I get a briefing like this before January 6th? And I was like, well, one, no one asked me to give you a briefing. And two, you know, that was really up to her sergeant at arms, the House sergeant at arms, to give her the briefing, which was Paul Irving at the time. And I know Chief Sund, who is the chief of police for the Capitol Police on January 6th, he's written a lot about that as well and spoken a lot about that in his request for the National Guard, or maybe not a request for the National Guard. And he also strongly blames Nancy Pelosi for that and for, he says, for denying his National Guard request. And, you know, with the National Guard, and I think I may have said this to you before, but the National Guard had not been at the Capitol and since 9/11, I think was the last time they had been there. So it doesn't matter like who the Speaker of the House was or who was in power in Congress. Like the National Guard wasn't going to come. No one was going to like the optics of the National Guard coming. And then also there was never any formal request made. I mean, we wouldn't have this debate. We wouldn't still be talking about this 5 years later if Sun had put in writing, I want the National Guard. But he didn't. It's all like he said, he told Paul Irving. Paul Irving told Nancy Pelosi and Pelosi denied it. Whether or not that happened, we don't know. There's no paper trail. There's no concrete evidence of that. So we don't know. My thought from knowing what I know and having been there on the Capitol was that Pelosi was never fully briefed. And I don't think she was fully aware of what was expected on that day. So, you know, it's fine to place blame, but that doesn't mean that that is based on truth.
Well, I know from reading your book and talking with you previously, Julie Farnham, that you saw in advance what the potential was. I mean, I know you probably didn't envision what actually occurred, but possibly you did. But you saw the potential for it. And so what were your actions that you took?
So we had three versions of the intelligence report. The first one was written before Trump's now infamous Be There, It'll Be Wild's tweet that he put out, I think around December 16th-ish or so, around mid-December. So there wasn't a lot of indication before that that there was going to be any wide-scale rally. We were expecting some protests, but there's protests every day in the Capitol. So that wasn't unusual. It wasn't until like mid-December. And keep in mind, too, you know, there was the MAGA 1 march, which was on November 14th. And then there was the MAGA 2 march, which was on December 12th. So there wasn't even a rally planned necessarily until after that second MAGA rally. And it was the same organizers, too, for those three rallies. There was a little bit of a split for the January 6th one, but that had more to do with internal politics of the groups that were organizing it than anything else. We, as you know, we got closer to January 6th, we saw that there were going to be thousands and thousands of people coming to DC. We knew that these extremist groups were going to be there. We knew that there was talk about weapons that were going to be there. And all in our final report that we did, which was on January 3rd, which did go out to Capitol Police leadership, said all those things. We said they're going to be armed. Congress is going to be the target. There's going to be extremist groups there. Plan accordingly. And that didn't happen. You know, with intelligence, too, intelligence is always informational. It's not operational. It's supposed to be used to inform the operational plans. It's not there to make the operational plans. That's a different section of a police department.
So the person receiving your information should have made those decisions, is what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And we didn't see that. In fact, we saw that they had removed some of the barriers the night before on January 5th. Leave wasn't canceled for the officers. Equipment wasn't staged. Not all the officers had the training. There was just a lot of missteps on the Capitol Police. They didn't coordinate with the agents. Even if the National Guard wasn't called in, like I said, they were never going to get called in. We do have mutual aid agreements with many other police departments in the area, and those were not coordinated until like the riot was well underway.
Well, I think it's interesting that the president says that these people were exercising their First Amendment rights and that therefore they were due a certain level of respect. And we've seen videos of them beating police officers with sticks and clubs and flags and all kinds of other stuff. And then since we even made our little appointment to speak today, we know that an ICE agent shot and killed a woman who was exercising her First Amendment rights, was not hitting any police officers with sticks, or she was smiling. Seems to be sort of a hypocrisy there. And instantly we were told that she was had weaponized her vehicle and that she was a domestic terrorist. You were with Homeland Security for a long time. How many people did you shoot and kill when you were working there?
I did not shoot and kill anyone in any other capacity or any other job. None of my coworkers shot and killed anyone, as far as I know.
You guys weren't doing your job.
And full disclosure, I worked for ICE. I worked for ICE from 2006 to 2008. I worked in Homeland Security Investigations, which is the criminal arm of ICE. There's like the administrative enforcement, which is ERO, enforcement and removal operations. Back then when I was there, because it was so long ago, now it's 20 years, Homeland Security Investigations, it wasn't called Homeland Security Investigations, it was just the Office of Investigations. But, you know, the people I worked with, you know, we were really trying to protect the integrity of the immigration system. And I don't think immigration enforcement in and of itself is a bad thing. Like, I think you have to have rules and laws and people should abide by them. But that doesn't mean like you target like random people. I mean, there's an economic element of immigrants in our community, whether they're documented or not. And I think to deny that, particularly when you get into like rural areas and our farming communities, like they are a huge part of our economy. And we can't deny that. And so when I was with ICE, we prioritized who we were going to remove. And top of the priority were criminals. And so and that makes sense. And I think that's not a bad thing. But when you start going after just anyone, that's when you get into like problems, because it becomes a taxpayer burden too, right? Because it costs a lot of money to arrest people. I think going back to what we were talking about before, I think this administration is cutting corners a bit in the sense that they're not giving people their full due process rights. Because everyone that we arrested when I was with ICE, you get two hearings, unless you're subject to expedited removal. But I won't get into like the weeds on removal laws. But, you know, you get a master hearing, which is like an arraignment where they tell you what your charges are and why you're being placed into removal proceedings, deportation proceedings. And then you have an individual hearing where they discuss the merits of your case and the judge decides, you know, if you're going to be removed or not. And you can appeal that too. You can appeal it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And so people have their due process and they have their opportunities to remain in the country or to state why they think they should remain or apply for asylum or whatever it may be. And I think we're seeing an erosion of that now. And that's really scary because if we start with immigrants, eventually U.S. citizens, like the shooting that we saw, you know, that's a U.S. citizen that was shot by an immigration agent. And that, I mean, there's many, many reasons why that's problematic, but that being one of them.
Well, she was disrespectful, the president said.
Well, that's First Amendment rights. You can be disrespectful to people and still be protected.
A lot of these organizations that you have worked with are there, whether the president is Democrat or Republican. You've been through other administrations when you were working with the government. How does the culture change so radically in such a short, in a 1 year time?
I think that's a good point. I worked under four different presidents, including President Trump in his first term. Actually, I was the USCIS, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. I was their representative on Trump's transition for his first term. So I was assigned up to DHS headquarters, and I was embedded with representatives from all the other agencies within DHS, along with his transition team, Trump's transition team for Homeland Security. So, you know, every administration is going to have their own priorities. Some of them you're going to agree with and some of them you won't. And I will say in my time working through four presidents, there were policies that I liked and ones that I did not like. I'm sorry, my dog is barking. I hope you can't hear him.
I cannot hear your dog.
Okay, well, he's upstairs, so.
He's a good dog. Who's a good dog? That was the next question on my list, is who's a good dog? But let's not get
Kima is a good dog.
Okay. Oh, yeah, there she goes. Yes, yeah. Go ahead. Sorry. Get back to where you were.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's going to always be policies that you agree with and disagree with, but I think the difference that we're seeing this time around is that, you know, the policies from previous administrations, they were based in law and their interpretation of law. I don't know if I think, and the courts have addressed this issue in that a lot of the policies that are being implemented are being struck down by the courts. And so that's where I think the difference is this time around is that we have policies that are not necessarily based in sound law.
We are chatting with Julie Farnham, and she is the author of a book called, it's called Domestic Darkness, An Insider's Account of the January 6th Insurrection and the Future of Right-Wing Extremism. And she's also a Substack contributor occasionally, not often enough, Julie, I want more.
I know, I should, yes.
And, but I always enjoy get all boiled over when I read your stuff. And one of the things that you were saying a couple of months ago was that the Democrats need to be less extreme in their opposition and that they need to acknowledge when the Trump administration does good things. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to, you know, she's smart. So Julie, what good things can you think of that the Trump administration has done in between the every 20 minutes doing something horrible?
Yeah, they do a lot of horrible things. I don't want to discount that at all. But I think as Democrats, to have credibility, we need to acknowledge, we can't just be seen as obstinate. Like, we need to acknowledge when there is common ground. Some of the things that I think have been good, and like you said, I don't think there's a lot of things, but some of the things like taking processed food out of schools, for example, I think that's not a bad move. I think like taking artificial coloring out of our foods is not a bad thing. Now, like, if you talk about like vaccine policy and stuff, there's a lot of bad there. But it's not, there are some things that are not necessarily negative. And that, I think, is the opportunity for Dems to be like, hey, like, we can work with some of these things. And then it gives them credibility and makes them look like they're really trying to do the right thing and not just oppose someone. And for example, we have a special election here in Arlington, Virginia. Actually, the election is today.
Oh, good.
Because one of our state senators, got appointed to Governor Spanberger's new administration. And I was talking to one of the candidates, and he was just like, well, Trump this and Trump that and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, hold up here. I said, you can't just be the person of not Trump. I said, there are real issues here in this community that I want to hear you talk about. And what are you going to do? Like, what are you going to do about the traffic? What are you going to do about the aging infrastructure that we have here? What are you going to do about overcrowding in schools? Like, that's what I want to hear about. Like, you're going to give me a lecture on like why you're not Trump. Like, this is one of the bluest places in the country. Like, okay, everyone who gets elected is not Trump here. So what are you going to do? And so the Democrats, I think, spend too much time saying what they're not instead of saying what they're going to be. And I think that's part of the reason why they've struggled the past couple of elections.
Well, so what were your thoughts then about Zohran Mamdani, the new mayor of New York City?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. First, I don't think the candidates, like, there wasn't a great pool of candidates. we'll just say that. I mean, I think his brand of politics is fine for a place like New York City. His brand of politics in Democrat is not going to float well in like parts of like Kansas, for example. I think it's fine for New York City and they elected him and that's great. And I think some of his ideas, like, I really like free childcare. My kids are a little bit older now, but when they were younger, I would have loved to have, you know, affordable childcare. And so I really would like to see some of those ideas implemented. His other stuff about like you know, grocery stores, government-run grocery stores, things like that. I mean, I think they're a little bit far-fetched and I don't see them really happening, but I think he's pushing forward new ideas and unique ideas. And it'll be interesting to see what he actually gets through and gets implemented, but we'll see.
I'm also curious to know what your thoughts are about the Supreme Court's current weighing of trans athletes. They're looking at whether or not it's, you know, there's like the case of a little girl who's in middle school and she was designated male when she was born, but she was presenting as female when she was like in the third grade. And she's not allowed to participate in track because she's a girl now, but wasn't always. So that's a case that's gone to the Supreme Court. And what are your thoughts?
Right. I think we're supposed to get it. Is it going to be the hearing today or the decision?
I'm not sure. Yeah, something's happening.
Yeah, it's coming up soon. I think I wrote about this on Substack, too. And I think we need to be realistic about it. I do have concern. Like, I'm all for trans rights. I think everyone should feel safe. Everyone should be treated equally. I do have concerns, though, about people who are biologically male competing in women's sports, because I'm afraid that it's going to disadvantage women in the long term. And I think we need to acknowledge that it can't just be like there's nuance there. There is nuance there. And I do worry about what the impact is, particularly on women and in women competing in sports, if they're actually competing against biologically male individuals, because bodies are different. Bodies are different. And I don't want to disadvantage women.
It is. There are shades of it's a shady area. And that's where those kinds of shady areas, or areas where there's grays and not blacks and whites, seem to be especially suffering right now.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think the other thing in the trans rights, and again, like, I am fully supportive if someone decides that they are not living in the right body. I absolutely believe that they should be treated equally and they should feel safe in their communities. But, you know, when a child says, you know, maybe I don't want to be a girl or I don't want to be a boy, like, I don't know if at that age in like third grade, they have the capacity to make that decision fully. And I understand the arguments of, you know, starting treatments and things before puberty, and that they're reversible and things like that. I understand that. But I really think that should be a personal decision, not the parents' decision. Because in third grade, it's essentially the parents' decision. And I think, you know, people should make that decision for their own and not have their parents make something that like life altering at that young of an age.
President Trump has talked a lot about a third term and about canceling elections and that kind of thing. Do you have any real fear that he might cancel upcoming elections, or is that a possibility?
I think that could be a possibility, and that is a very, very scary one. I don't think he will run for president for a third term just because I don't think he's healthy enough. He's an old man. He is an old man. Like, there's no way around that. Like, he is an old man. He complained a lot about Joe Biden. Joe Biden was an old man too. But I just don't think he has the health or the age to run for a third term. But that doesn't mean that he won't try to impact elections going forward, including, you know, potentially canceling elections.
I heard a comedian say that women are to blame for all the problems in this country because every time one of them runs for president, we get stuck with this guy. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about who the Democrats, I mean, my choice would be Julie Farnham, but who do you think the Democrats should get behind, and when should they start getting behind another presidential candidate?
Well, I'd like to see us have a pretty good pool, at least for the primary, and not necessarily narrow it down to one person just yet, because I think it's better when there is a pool. And I think there should have been more of a pool the last election with Democrats, and let and let Democrats decide who they want representing them in the presidency. So I think Newsom's probably going to be on that list. And I am, and all these people that I'm going to name, I would be happy with them being president. But Newsom for sure. I'd like to see Rahm Emanuel run. I think he would be good. I like him. I like Whitmer. She's great. Pete Buttigieg. He's my guy. I love him.
Yep.
Those would be my four, and maybe Shapiro too. Maybe Waltz, but I think we finally have like a pretty good bench, and it's taken us a few years to get that, but I think we have a good bench now.
The resistance of Americans to vote for a woman seems to be very solid. And I wonder if you also worry that a resistance to a gay candidate or a Jewish candidate would also be a factor.
I don't think being Jewish or gay would be as big of a factor as being a woman, to be honest. I think we still have a long ways to go in this country when it comes to women in politics. I did American University's Women in Politics program, which I love, and it helps prepare women to enter the political field, learn about campaigning and all that, and with the intent to close the gender gap. Because the U.S. is, you know, when you look at it, industrialized countries, developed countries, we are like not high on the list with female representation in our politics at all levels of government. And that's really unfortunate. Some woman someday will break through, and I can't wait for that day, but I don't know if we're ready quite yet. But I think, you know, people said that about a Black president too, you know, not that long ago. And Obama was a great president. So it's coming. It will happen. But I think we are more likely to have a Jewish or gay president before we have a female president.
Probably. Unless you run. This is Julie Farnham that we're speaking with, and her book is called Domestic Darkness, An Insider's Account of the January 6th Insurrection and the Future of Right-Wing Extremism, her first book. I know she got a new one coming soon, I hope. And you can also find her on Substack and occasionally here on From the Bookshelf. Julie Farnham, thanks so much for hanging out with us. Good to talk to you.
All right, great talking to you. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.